At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the founders, CEOs, clinicians, journalists, politicians and, based on last week's show, mixed martial artists that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a founder and a CEO of a health tech business myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc is helping healthcare systems and individuals find, diagnose, risk assess, and prevent cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and chronic kidney disease. Our Healthy Heart Check, which is available at every single high street pharmacy and online at PocDoc.co or at Amazon, is the number one diagnostic test on the high street, apart from COVID and pregnancy. And it can give you the equivalent of the NHS health check in just 8 minutes using your phone. So if you want more information, go to PocDoc.co or go and ask your local pharmacy. And thank you, as ever, to PocDoc for supporting this show. Thanks, as I always say, to UK Health Radio for the live platform. Johan and Raffaella and the team do an incredible job. All the other presenters are amazing. I can completely recommend you listening to as much of the other shows as possible. The content's great. And we love being on UK Health Radio. Thank you also if you are listening on any of the podcast channels. We get downloads now from people in over 50 countries a month, which is just wild. And if you're watching on YouTube, the long form, thank you. It's good to see you. And then finally, if you're on my Instagram channel, which is at Steve Roost, thank you for engaging with all of the best bits that we post there. Last week's show was incredible. We had UFC legend Igor Araujo on, who took us through his childhood, his brutal childhood, and then his dream of getting to the UFC, which I think if anyone is interested in understanding what resilience means and overcoming obstacles, and if they need a different change of perspective, then I can completely recommend the show. It will probably change your life. It certainly changed mine. And I'm sure this show as well will change your life. And it really gives me huge pleasure today to be doing a show with one of my new favorite people from 2025, is Valentina Milanova. And Valentina is the founder of a business called Day, which is D-A-Y-E. And Day's mission in life is to create equality in women's care, particularly in reproductive health, by, among other things, eradicating cervical cancer and dispelling myths that periods should be painful or otherwise discomforting, and delivering products and services through innovation that make women's lives better. Valentina is an incredible entrepreneur. She's featured in the Forbes 30 Under 30 two times. She has had her research published in leading journals in the reproductive health space. And the Day diagnostic tampon, which we will go into details on, was named as one of the inventions of the year by Time magazine in 2024. Valentina, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Steve. Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So let's kind of like jump straight into it. So at what point did you kind of get the bug, if you like, around health and healthcare and wanting to make a difference?
My particular bug is in women's health, and I, through my own personal experiences, my own gynecological health horror stories, and then speaking to my friends and my peers, and gradually realizing just how deep the women's health crisis is, I became really inspired, and still to this day, genuinely believe that solving for women's health in particular is one of the biggest societal challenges which we have to overcome before we turn our attention to pop. You know, colonizing Mars and flying cars and AI. I really wish we would solve some of our problems closer to Earth. And I still believe that we can't have healthy societies or healthy economies unless we take full advantage of the potential that women bring, which we can't do if women are held back by a lack of medical understanding on how our physiology works.
Well, and let's dig into that. So what, when you said crisis, why is it a crisis and how have we got to this point?
It's years of underfunding, decades of underfunding mainly, which has resulted in women not being included in clinical trials at the same rate as men. Research into female specific diseases is incredibly lacking. So first, we have a fundamental funding problem. So currently, about in the UK, about 2.5% of our public health budgets go to the entirety of women's health, which is woefully
Wait,
insufficient to cover.
hold on, back that up a second. So, like, only 2.5% of funding in the UK healthcare system goes to, like, specifically women's health issues.
Yeah, and that 2.5% has to stretch to cover everything from breastfeeding to menopause to endometriosis, polycystic ovarian syndrome, various gynecological cancers. So it's obviously
Oh,
insufficient.
it includes the gynecological cancers as well.
Everything women's health.
Wow. That doesn't strike me as very much money.
Oh, that's tiny. And thanks to the work that Dame Leslie Reagan has been doing and well-being of women, who are a phenomenal organization that pushes forward gynecological health research in the UK, we finally have women's health hubs that have been established in the UK. But there's two issues with that. So first of all, the budget for these women's health hubs is again woefully inappropriate. It's £25 million, which has to cover the whole of the UK. And the funding is not ring-fenced. So even though it's named women's health hubs, the funding can actually go towards any types of healthcare. So that's the public sector. If we look at the private sector, the situation is actually worse. About 1% of venture capital globally goes to the entirety of women's health. And female innovators are more likely to develop medical and diagnostic devices for women's health, yet women receive about 2.4% of global venture capital funding. So it's a two-sided problem where we're underinvesting both from a public perspective and a private perspective.
So let's try and dig into this. I love talking to you, and I'm really pleased that you're on the show. And this is exactly what I hoped the show would be when we booked you. So when we went through, you know, your publicist and things like that. I'm kidding.
When you send me a WhatsApp.
let's break this up. So we've got research, i.e., you said that there's effectively been a complete lack of specifically funded research into women's health issues. Then
Yeah,
you
well, just on that
go on.
point, until 1993, women were not allowed to take part in clinical trials in the US and 1995 in the UK because we had this patriarchal view that women had to be protected as the vessels of life from everything, including medical innovation. So what that means on a very practical level is that the majority of painkillers, antibiotics, sleeping aid medications were never designed for nor tested on the female physiology. And this research bias actually starts before we can even go to human clinical trials. It starts in animal models where researchers prefer to use male mice, male rabbits over female lab animals because they think that the menstrual cycle will pollute the quality of their data.
Yeah, so I was going to pick up on that. So my wife, Kieran, who I've spoken to many times about you and your amazing business, and she has a background in clinical trials and things like that. It's not like she believes in what you just said, but she referenced that the menstrual cycle, hormonal
No.
fluctuations, not in, she didn't say mice and rabbits, she was talking about women, and that was the reason that was commonly cited up until whenever it was the 90s. So is that true in any way, or is that just junk?
was the real reason why researchers were hesitant to include women in clinical trials is that we thought it would be incredibly hard to control for the menstrual cycle and to control for hormonal fluctuations. And the excuse that was given publicly was, women could be pregnant at any point in time, even if they've just had negative pregnancy tests. Therefore, we shouldn't include them for patient safety. And from a hormonal fluctuations perspective, yes, women do go through hormonal fluctuations in terms of, the entirety of our lifetime, but then also on a monthly cadence when we have our menstrual cycles. But it's not like men don't go through hormonal fluctuations. And if you look at the daily spikes of male hormonal fluctuations, they are actually significantly more aggressive
Is that
than the
right?
month, than the month-wide spikes that
What male hormone?
women experience.
I know we're good with, I'm not going to talk about, but what male hormone spike? I've not heard that before.
Cortisol, adrenaline,
Wow. Okay, that makes sense. So research is basically, it starts there. So there's not been enough funding for specific research. Then you've got provision of care, which is the public sector 2.5%. So why is that so woefully small? Do you think?
testosterone.
I mean,
It's a number of different factors. So in the UK in particular, the fundamental issue is that the healthcare system is bankrupt, and we keep trying to pretend that it's not, but it is. So it's very challenging to add on to an already bankrupt system. Even though the NHS, I recently learned this fact and I find it fascinating that the NHS's annual budget is equivalent to the national GDP of the country of Greece. So even though we spend a lot on healthcare, and I'm happy to go into with you some specifics of where I think we're overspending and where we should
sure.
be spending less, even though we have high budgets, the system itself is bankrupt. And one of the things that I'm equally passionate about when we're talking about healthcare is not just women's health, but also financial innovation. Within the NHS in particular, we need financial innovation. We need new business models, and we urgently need to stop pretending that the system isn't bankrupt.
Makes sense.
So in
Go
the
on.
way in which this relates to women's health is that it's very challenging to add yet another budget category to an already bankrupt system.
Where does women's health stop? Because what I don't think you mean, but I might be wrong, and you will correct me, I'm sure. Women's health doesn't necessarily include things that happen to both men and women, or does
It
it
does.
sometimes? Sometimes it does.
It absolutely does. Across diseases that are seen in both the male and the female population, we see women get diagnosed significantly later than men. So, for example, cardiovascular disease, we get diagnosed an average of 4 years later than men. Cancer, we get diagnosed 3 years later than men. Diabetes, women tend to get diagnosed later than men. And again, the reason for this is that a lot of the diagnostic criteria that we follow in modern medicine were established on the basis of what we know about the male physiology, not necessarily what we know about the female physiology. So when I talk about the crisis that exists today in women's health, it has to do with female-specific conditions like polycystic ovarian syndrome, but it also has to do with cardiovascular health and diabetes and general health.
And so how does all of that background, how did that all kind of flow into you deciding to do what you're doing at day? Like what was how does that macro get funneled into all the incredible things that you've done? Where did it start?
So at Day, we have a very ambitious mission. Some might call it unrealistically ambitious. We want to create a whole suite of tools, a whole arsenal of tools that female patients can use in order to better manage their vaginal, menstrual, and hormonal health. And one of the aspects of Day that is quite unusual when, we think about startups that tend to be quite narrowly focused, you have one customer, you typically have one product. We have a very rich product portfolio, and we've taken the whole product innovation cycle in-house. So we do in-house manufacturing, in-house clinical trials, and then we bring our products to the customer. And our central hypothesis is that we want to, where possible, repurpose existing medical devices or existing solutions that women already utilize on a regular basis, like the menstrual tampon, and make these existing devices work harder for the patient. So instead of asking the patient to adopt an entirely new way of behaving, an entirely new device, we instead tap into an existing behavior that a patient might have, like use tampons, and make the tampons work harder for the patient.
Which and all of that is one of the reasons why you've been sort of highlighted as so innovative. But how did it all start?
Well, philosophically, it all started when, I had my first menstrual cycle, which was extremely painful when I was very young. I was 9 years old, and no
Wow.
one had had the chance to have a conversation with me
No,
yet about.
is 9 young? 9 seems young.
It was young when I was having my menstrual cycles, though, like 20 years ago, but now it's no longer considered so young because due to exposure to synthetic hormones and endocrine disruptors, girls are starting their menstrual cycles younger and younger. So now it's no longer as shocking as it was when it happened to me. And for a year, I didn't realize that I was having my menstrual cycle. I thought I had some kind of a disease, and I felt very ashamed and embarrassed to even tell my parents. So I hid it from my parents. And then when I confessed to my parents, they took me to an OBGYN, and I was immediately prescribed contraception, which is the still to
Whoa.
this day the standard of care for painful menstrual cycles. Even though contraception was not designed to treat heavy and painful menstruation, we still use it as the first line of defense treatment for heavy and painful periods. And then, growing up throughout my teenage years, I had other significant gynecological health challenges. I had a very large ovarian cyst, which it took about a year for me to get diagnosed with, which is considered quite short, but that was a year of extreme chronic pain where I couldn't go to school. I
Oh,
couldn't
wow.
really get out of bed. And it was just completely debilitated. And I got tested for everything from IBS, kidney disease, all sorts of conditions before I was given a gynecological exam to find the cyst. And still with ovarian cysts, there's two schools of thought. We don't have a standard of care that's universally accepted, which was my experience as well. I was admitted to hospital one evening to be operated on in the morning, to have surgery in the morning. I was prepared for surgery. And then the morning shift of doctors came to the hospital and said, well, actually, for this type of ovarian cyst, we're not going to do surgery.
Right.
Which, again, happens to a lot of women. It's just the gynecological health experience is full of question marks and painful experiences. And, my own journey. And then what I started hearing from my friends and my peers. And when I learned about the systemic issues in women's health, I became very focused on trying to create solutions that I would want to use personally or that I would want to recommend to my friend group.
And where was the leap? Because there are lots of people that have tried and have succeeded, and some maybe unfortunately didn't succeed in women's health. There's lots of different ways to approach it. How did you come upon this very diagnostic angle? Right. So I feel like a lot of people get a bit put off by hardcore med tech as founders. I mean, I POC
Oh,
Doc is
yeah.
hardcore med tech, right? So we've spoken a bit about this previously, but that's not necessarily the easiest path to start with.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say that there was one singular experience that I can point to. It was a combination of factors and multiple things happening and evolving. I started this company with an idea for a pain-relieving tampon. This was the first product that we brought to market, a localized solution for period and pelvic pain that would have a two-in-one function where you would both have something to absorb your menstrual fluid and at the same time a solution for painful menstruation. After we introduced the service to market, I was reading research papers about gynecological health diagnostics and learning more about the cervical cancer screening gap, about how many people don't take part in regular cervical cancer screening or in STI screening or vaginal infection screening. And I had the idea of, okay, why are we doing it with a swab? And why are we inviting women to these time-consuming and invasive clinic appointments when instead we could enable them to use a tool that they're familiar with? with and comfortable with, namely the tampon, to obtain a much better quality sample from their reproductive tract. And that was the second product idea. But yeah, medical devices are incredibly hard. I started this company when I was 22, which was a big advantage because I had no idea what was coming. I think if I knew, I may not have started it.
The value of naivety, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, it was very, very valuable at that time. And gradually we just, you know, solved one problem after the other, like one regulatory approval, one clinical trial, one machine after the other. But I've been doing this for 8 years. It's and it feels like the company is becoming more and more complex. But at the same time, as a founder, your ability to deal with complexity increases and increases as well.
This is true. I'm going to ask one question, then we're going to go for our commercials. Then I want to come back again to unpick this sort of central tenet of your philosophy, which is making existing products that women use work harder. So tampons working for cervical cancer screening, for STI screening. I think that's a really kind of smart insight and actually runs counter to where I think a lot of diagnostics gets in trouble, which is why don't we really make the most complex, highly over-engineered solution and then go try and sell it to people who might want it. So that's why I love that philosophy. So my question is, with the pain relieving tampon, what's the actual biochemical process that works to relieve the pain of that? Because pain's quite generalized, or is it not within painful periods, or like how?
Yeah, well, when you have painful menstruation, they're produced by hormones that are released in your uterus that cause contraction of the uterus, so your endometrial lining, which thickens every month to, you know, welcome a fertilized egg. It thickens every month, and if there isn't a fertilized egg to embed itself in the endometrial lining, you need a biological mechanism to expel that lining, and that happens through these cramps, the menstrual cramps that a lot of people feel. So using the vagina and the vaginal mucosa in particular in order to deliver medications in women is actually one of our best methods for delivering medications altogether in women. Pain relief in particular, but all sorts of medications, because you have direct access to a very absorbent mucosal membrane, the vaginal mucosal membrane. Just as you have medications that are sprayed in the nose with the nasal membrane for quick absorption, you can have medications that are delivered vaginally. And the advantage of this approach is that you can use a lower dose, therefore making the medication safer. Vaginally administered medications tend to have a localized effect versus systemic effect as they get recycled through the first pass uterine effect. So you automatically disengage your digestive tract, you disengage the liver. So you have fewer systems that are involved in processing vaginally administered medications. And the idea for pain relieving tampon is not novel. So for example, Procter & Gamble tried to create a pain relieving tampon in the 1960s, and then they gave up because they thought it wouldn't be needed by patient populations. They thought painful periods weren't that big of a deal, which is generally how we think about painful menstruation. Even though it affects 90% of the population, we don't think of it as a serious health condition. And a day we had the idea to create a solution for this problem that affects 9 out of 10 women have some level of period pain.
Wow, that's really insightful, and some shocking statistics in there that we will pick up on throughout the rest of the show. So we have to go to our first commercial break, but we will be back in 2 minutes with my guest this week, Valentina Milanova, the CEO and founder of Day. We will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of today's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, the amazing, inspirational Valentina Milanova, CEO and founder of Day. So hearing you talk just before the break, Valentina, how much do you think women have been sort of let down by the establishment and almost brainwashed into thinking that something is just part of being a woman and is irresolvable as opposed to the truth. But I don't, that might be wrong. I might be off base on that, but that's sort of what it sounds a bit like is happening or
Yeah,
happened.
it's a real problem, and it's a very multifaceted, complex issue, because it starts with doctors and medical professionals not being trained about gynecological health and not being told during medical school about menopause and endometriosis, which then can manifest itself as medical misogyny, which is a very commonly reported, anecdotally reported issue where female patients don't feel that they're getting the level of support that they need. They don't feel that they're getting answers or solutions for the issues that they present to A&E or to general practice with. And we see that in the data. So, for example, when women present to A&E with a heart attack, according to the British Cardiovascular Health Association, about 50% of female heart attack patients get turned away
Wow.
from A&E because the A&E doctors are trained to recognize the heart attack symptoms that present in the male physiology, not the ones that present in the female physiology. Similarly, when female patients request pain relief in A&E, on average, they have to wait 27 minutes longer than male patients. So we do
Why is
have
that? Where
data.
does that? Where does that come from? Do they know where that? Why that? Why is that? What's that about?
Female pain is often wrongly associated with hysteria. It's seen as not as real, not as serious
Oh,
as
man.
male pain. And there are also a lot of unhelpful myths around how women have a higher threshold for pain because of our physiology being suited for labor and delivery.
Right. And these things have just sort of become endemic, effectively. These people probably don't even know that they're thinking that in
Yes,
some cases.
when there isn't awareness being raised about the problems of medical misogyny or the problems about the fact that women weren't included in clinical research, doctors don't know about the issue, patients don't know about the issue, society at large doesn't know that women were not allowed to take part in clinical trials until 1993, that medications like ibuprofen, they weren't tested on the female physiology to the same extent that they were tested on the male physiology. We just assume that because something is available on a supermarket shelf or behind the pharmacy counter, and it's, for example, the packaging is pink, we think that it has been tested and is safe for female patients.
It's yeah, it blows my mind every time we deal with this subject. And like in some ways, I think it's amazing that individuals like you and many others are doing this. And then I think it's a tragedy that you sort of have to do it, you know? I don't know if you.
I'm grateful that we're having these conversations, but I do feel it's very important to raise awareness about what female innovators have to go through, especially if you're a woman in women's health. It's like you're playing the computer game on super hard mode, because first you have to go through the gender fundraising challenge, right? You have to raise funding, and a very small pot of the overall funding is available to you. Secondly, if you manage to overcome the gender fundraising gap, then you have to overcome the gender data gap. You have to conduct your own clinical trials and your own clinical investigations because there's so little pre-existing evidence and published papers on women's reproductive health. And then if you manage to get through the funding gap and the data gap, you're left with this third completely arbitrary hurdle, which is that advertising is very challenging for women's health innovators because large platforms like Google, Meta, Transport for London, TikTok, Amazon actively restrict gynecological health content. And this is something that my company has experienced. A lot of other female health innovators have experienced. Our content gets classified as adult content or political content or,
What, because you mentioned vagina or you say what, like what
No, yeah, vagina is a big offender.
okay.
But some very Plain female health experiences ranging from menstruation to breastfeeding to menopause can often get categorized as adult or political content. And
Wow.
recently we ran an out-of-home campaign in London on bus stops, and our content wasn't approved for the underground, for the tube, because
What?
we were showing the speculum, which is this medical device that gets used in almost every gynecological health appointment. It's
Yes.
quite an invasive device. It's certainly outdated. It needs a redesign. It's had the same design since the times of the Roman Empire, quite literally. And that was deemed to be too offensive. And then the ads that we were allowed to place on bus stops, they featured our tampon.
Yeah.
Because we're advertising a diagnostic
Tampon.
tampon,
Yeah.
and various different members of the public across London took it upon themselves to censor the ads, to place stickers on the tampon so the tampon wouldn't be visible, to remove certain words like STI or uterus, to spray paint over them or to sticker over them. And this is happening
No. This
in London,
happened. This happened. This has happened recently.
in one of the most progressive cities. And we had the same experience when we were advertising in New York as well, which is again another considered very progressive city. We wanted to show an illustration, an anatomically representative illustration of the vulva, because very few people differentiate between the vulva and the vagina, and it's very important to be able to name our own physiology. You know, we talk about men's health conditions all the time. We talk about prostate cancer and testicular cancer, and no one is offended from us talking about the
No,
testes.
no.
But
And
when you talk about,
no one's offended about talking about a finger up the bum for the prostate check.
yeah, no, that is acceptable. But yeah, we had the same experience in New York. And then I was recently on a BBC radio interview, and I was asked to explain how our diagnostic tampon works. And I said, you know, it's inserted in the vaginal canal and it reaches the cervix. And the journalist, the female journalist, immediately interrupted me and said, okay, that's enough from Valentina now. Thank you, Valentina. We appreciate your time. And she's like,
No way.
cut the interview. And I was told later that because my slot was during lunchtime, they thought that their listeners wouldn't be comfortable hearing about the vaginal canal and the cervix during lunch. But there is no other word for the vaginal
Well,
canal. It's a medical term. There's
I mean, what are
no other
we,
way.
what are we talking about? I don't understand. That's insane. Look, I mean, Johan will love this. Johan, you and the team at UK Health Radio have got one up on the BBC radio, which is that it's lunchtime now, and we're talking about cervixes and vaginas and all the stuff that the BBC won't let you talk about. Look how happy he is. He's absolutely fired up about that. That's mental. That's absolutely barking mad that they would interrupt an interview because you used a biological term. That's nuts. Like, what,
It's just the reality of being a women's health innovator. And I'm sharing this not to put off anyone from becoming a women's health innovator, but it's very important that we're aware of these challenges so we can name them and address them.
And how do you follow up in those instances with TfL, who controls advertising on the underground, or with the BBC, or do you just let
Oh, I never let it go. I always follow up.
it go? Of course you do. Of course
But
you do.
I do have to be realistic about the amount of power that I personally have and that my very small company has. So it tends to fall on deaf ears. But I do like to think that at least someone has said something, right? That at least I will be the start to a conversation, maybe the start to a thinking process. And fortunately, when our ads got censored in London, members of our community, so people who use their products and services, took it upon themselves to go to the different bus stops and clean them out
That's
from
amazing.
the stickers, which was lovely. Yeah.
That, I mean, that shows you've got real supporters, users, customers that love it.
Yeah, and just women that want to see gynecological health conversations out there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it probably wasn't women that vandalized those pictures, was it?
That would be my guess.
I
I don't
mean,
have any evidence, but that would be my guess, yes.
yeah, that's shocking. I mean, that you would be so angry or incensed that you would then go and find stickers, to then cover up the thing.
And
Like, I
then when the
mean,
stickers were removed, you would come back and spray paint over
wow.
the image. But
Wow.
for me, an even bigger offender is Google and Meta. So with Google, for example, we've been stuck in this debate for a few months now as to whether the diagnostic tampon from DAY, which is used for STI and HPV screening, whether this is contraception. So they keep telling us that it's contraception, even though in our understanding, tampons have never been used as a contraception, probably in the history of time. That's issue number one. But issue number two, why is Google UK stopping advertisers from talking about contraception? Like, what's wrong with contraception? I know that in the US, contraception is a politically sensitive subject at the moment, but US culture and politics shouldn't affect what people in the UK can talk about and what information they can
But
get.
does that mean that, like, for example, who, like, is it Tampax? Who are the, what,
Well,
do other retailers advertise on Google for tampons or not? And is that okay?
yeah, so it's a lot of women's health companies that face this issue. It's not just they. It's you know, there's a coalition of 60 different women's health companies, and you know, we create petitions for parliament, we go and present in front of Congress, we demand meetings with Google and Meta, we file legal complaints, etc. But this issue just keeps persisting. We need to keep fighting
Who
against
are they
it.
protecting, or like what are worried about? What do you think is really going on here? Because they love money. I know that.
Exactly.
They love
Yes.
money.
Yeah, we're giving you money, so just
Yeah.
take it. But what's really frustrating, and I want to call out two organizations. So one is called Sense Her Ship. This is the UK entity that is fighting against censorship, against women's health content online. And then the US equivalent is called the Center for Intimacy Justice. And we've had investigations by the New York Times, investigations by The Guardian, Cosmopolitan, like any press outlet you can imagine has covered this. But the issue still persists. So it's a combination of factors. First of all, women's health is a small industry. You know, our advertising power isn't that large. So we're not that meaningful in the eyes of the large advertising platforms. And secondly, the algorithms that flag which ad is adult content, which ad is political content, they are again gender biased.
Right.
Yeah.
Written by men, basically, is what you mean by that, right?
And written by men, but also the female body is over-sexualized in medical research, in society, in politics, in advertisement. So we had this image of a pregnant belly because
Right.
one of the gynecological health screens that we offer detects pathogens that are harmful during pregnancy and harmful for conception. And this image of the pregnant belly was deemed to be sexual content
Oh, wow.
by
Yeah,
both Meta and Google.
what do you do with that, right? I mean, that's crazy.
It's a long-winded societal change that needs to take place. It's going to take decades. And that's why it's so important that we keep pushing and we don't give up in the face of these seemingly insurmountable challenges.
So, and when did you realize that you could use a tampon to actually diagnose cervical cancer? Because that's a huge step, I
Yeah.
think, isn't it?
Well, it's very interesting because the first clinical trials that used tampons as a gynecological health screening solution are from the 1980s and the 1990s. And it was actually the former FDA General Commissioner that did the first clinical trial, and then a researcher from the University of Westminster that did the second clinical trial on using tampons to collect vaginal samples. Both of these clinical trials found that women found tampons more acceptable for screening, and that they increased sensitivity and specificity of STI and HPV screening because they were able to obtain a lot more bacterial mass. So this again is knowledge that we've had, but we haven't had the funding to do anything with the scientific research because women's health is so underfunded. And then we at DAY, we designed our own tampon design, our own applicator design in order to make sure that the tampon fully covers the whole of the vaginal canal, the cervical area to collect a lot of bacterial mass to afford reliable gynecological health screening. We conducted our own clinical trials, published the results from these trials, and are now working with the National Health Service, with US insurance, with retailers like Boots in the UK.
And What was when you first came up with it? I'll ask this question, then we'll go for our last commercial break. But when you first realized that you could do it, or maybe when you first got when I started talking to people about it, was there a lot of pushback about it, or
There
was it?
still is. There still is because tampon is a stigmatized word. We think tampons are not serious enough. And this makes it very hard for me to fundraise and very hard for me to be taken seriously as a medical innovator because what we make are pain relieving tampons and diagnostic tampons. And I often get this feedback from researchers or from investors being like, oh, neat project. Not for me. Like, sir, this is a multi-million pound company which is employing, like over 50 people. It is not a project, but
Yeah,
thank you.
that's very, that's not a nice way to say no to anyone, to
Yeah,
say
that's
no
why I was
to a
so
project.
happy about the Time magazine coverage because it was so cool to see the tampon in Time
Well,
magazine.
let's talk about that because that's really special. The diagnostic tampon being named in Time as one of their inventions of the year in 2024. So we're going to go for our last commercial break now with my founder on this, sorry, my founder, my guest on this week's show, founder and CEO of Day, Valentina Milanova. We'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to the final part of this week's show with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, the incredible Valentina Milanova, who is the founder and CEO of Day. So, how did the Time magazine incredible situation come to pass? Where the diagnostic tampon was listed as one of the inventions of 2024.
I thought just because it was a tampon that it would never be selected, it would again be seen as something not serious enough. But the journalist who was interviewing us after we submitted our application was a person who had struggled with some of the conditions that we addressed through the tampon. I'm not going to go into any specifics, but
Sure.
she had a lot of painful experiences and could firsthand really appreciate the impact that this health innovation could have, not just on her own life, but on the lives of others like her. So I think it was really because of the advocacy of this journalist who was interviewing us for as part of the selection process.
Okay. And did things change after that? You got a lot of coverage for it.
Somewhat. I wouldn't say that it was revolutionary. It's just, another badge of honor. I think you have this experience as well as an NHS innovator and a medtech innovator. You just have to keep adding to your credibility. You have to keep adding the ISO certifications, the CE marks, the framework
Yeah.
approvals, etc. And you hope that one day it will be enough.
So with the diagnostic tampon, what's the full range of things that you can diagnose? So you mentioned STIs, all of them or some of them, and cervical cancer, and then I think you mentioned a few other things.
Yeah, so we can detect the most common STIs, chlamydia, gonorrhea, trichomoniasis, which in female patients, so chlamydia specifically in female patients, is very frequently asymptomatic. So in men, when you have chlamydia, you have stinging, itching, burning, unusual discharge. In women, when you have chlamydia, 70% of patients don't have any symptoms at all. But when you have chlamydia for a prolonged period of time and you leave it untreated because you didn't know that you had it, it causes chronic pelvic inflammation, chronic pelvic pain, as well as scarring to the fallopian tubes, which can reduce your fertility. So it's an important condition to diagnose and treat promptly. Trichomoniasis, which is an STI, can very frequently appear to be bacterial vaginosis or a yeast infection. So it's very important that you know exactly which pathogen is causing your symptoms so that you can personalize your treatment pathway. And this is important for the patient in terms of treatment efficacy, and it's important for our public health system so that we don't contribute to antimicrobial resistance
Yep.
by prescribing the wrong type of antibiotic. And we also screen for 14 high-risk HPV strains, which cause cervical cancer. Cervical cancer is entirely preventable with regular screening and vaccination, but currently in the UK, no ICB, no region is meeting its 80% screening target. Everyone is falling behind, and particularly post-COVID, we've seen an increase in the rates of cervical cancer, which is really unfortunate again for preventable cancer. We've seen an increase in the rates of cervical cancer for women
Oh
aged
wait, so
30 to 40.
the rates have gone up.
Because people don't get screened.
Wow. That's probably one of the, I mean, I'm not sure what other cancers have gone up like that. A lot of them, or maybe they've all gone up. I'm not sure. Anyway, but that's still not good news.
I need to take a look at the statistics. So that's what we do with the diagnostic tampon. We can help you understand whether you have HPV, which causes cervical cancer. And finally, we screen the vaginal microbiome, the vaginal microbiota, which is the immune system to your reproductive tract. So if you have a disrupted vaginal microbiome, you are more prone to STIs, more prone to recurrent vaginal infections, more prone to recurrent UTIs, and you have a higher risk of miscarriage and preterm labor. Vaginal microbiome screening used to be a very costly diagnostic tool, but post-COVID, we have quantitative PCR technologies. Every lab has a PCR instrument. So it's become a lot more affordable, and I'm really hoping that it becomes part of mainstream care for recurrent vaginal infections, recurrent UTIs, and persistent unexplained infertility. Because at the moment on the NHS, you have to wait to have three recurrent miscarriages before you're referred for specialist care. And what if your miscarriage was being caused by ureaplasma or mycoplasma, which are easily treatable pathogens? The treatment protocol is not complex. Women shouldn't be asked to have multiple cycles of recurrent bacterial vaginosis or multiple recurrent miscarriages before they receive adequate care.
I completely agree with you. So, and with the technology itself, how does it work? Like, if a woman listening today wants to go and try and use it or buy it or get it, like and then what happens?
Oh, it's super simple. You go on yourday.com, which is our website, and then you order a kit. The kit arrives on your doorstep, usually within 24 hours. Inside the kit, you will find a tampon, which you're already familiar with. You insert the tampon, you wear it for 20 minutes, you take it out, place it in a sterile pouch, and then you ship that back to one of our accredited labs using the postal service, very similar to the POCDOC experience. And then you receive your results and aftercare online. So you can book nurse consultations, OBGYN consultations to have via video call or phone call. You can get prescription treatments based on your results and your lifestyle, and your medical history delivered to your door. So it greatly simplifies the gynecological health screening experience.
And are those, what do you, how many women that do it want to go and speak to someone versus the online experience generally being like sufficient? Like, how does that, because I imagine that post-test pathway is really valued by them.
It's very important because it's so hard to get a GP appointment with a GP who actually understands women's health. So we have about 25% of our patients who take up the consultations and about 12% who take up the treatment option as well. But the results themselves are very, they're designed to be accessible and friendly and beautifully presented, and they stay yours forever. So that's something that I feel really passionately about, enabling people to have access to their health record. It was a big culture shock for me when I moved from Bulgaria to the UK that you don't ever see your health data. Like when you leave a doctor in Bulgaria, you leave with, a pack of printed results and your lab results, et cetera. Whereas in the UK, you're just told what the results are. And maybe now some people have access to the NHS app. I have a lot of UX and UI criticisms for the NHS app. So people, when using the day service, you have your hormone health results, your cervical health results, your vaginal microbiome, your STI results, your period and pelvic pain, your whole medical health history, all neatly systematized in one health dashboard, which means that when you then go and seek care, you can advocate for yourself. You go armed with your data.
And I mean, I'm guessing the feedback from women has been really positive about
I'm
things.
really proud of the NPS score that we have, the Net Promoter Score that we have. We're the best rated women's health company in the UK on Amazon and Trustpilot.
That's fantastic. And how much, and is that consistent across the other code? Because you're not just in the UK, you're in the US and in Europe, I believe.
Yep, we are, yeah.
And what's the difference? You know, as you mentioned a couple of times, I mean, the US politically is, well, the political situation in the US seems to treat women's health very differently, or rather, women's health seems to be a political football or a political issue in ways that in
Yeah.
other countries it is not. So how have you had to adapt or do things differently there or
Yeah.
not?
Well, it's very interesting because when I speak to people from the US, they have such a high opinion of the NHS, and they think that the NHS is like perfectly functioning and just in incredible. But in reality, like no American would ever wait 16 weeks for a specialized care appointment, even if they're uninsured. So it's I wouldn't say that the standard of gynecological care is lower in the US. There's all of these, political and societal challenges and religious challenges, but you have your FSA HSA insurance, you have your workplace insurance. If you don't have workplace insurance, you can get the Obamacare insurance, and you have an appointed gynecologist. You have a women's health expert. Whereas what I've always found very strange about the UK women's health setup is that you have your GP. And they are supposed to be your women's health specialist. And then you only see a gynecologist for like cancer surgery.
Yes, and then when you go to the hospital to give birth, you get a midwife, but you get them when you go to the hospital. So yeah, no, that is definitely a difference. So what have you kind of taken? You've been doing this on, if you actually, I'll ask a different question. If you hadn't have decided to go on this 8-year long journey of being an entrepreneur, what was number two on the list?
I started my career in the UK working in think tanks. I was really interested in behavioral economics and using behavioral economics as a way to incentivize positive societal change. I also worked as a journalist because I really like writing. I love words. So if I wasn't working on this, I imagine it would be like a women's health charity, maybe. I always say that when I grow up, I want to be like Dame Leslie Reagan. She's incredible. She's the chair of well-being of women. And well-being of women, if I can just quickly give them a shout
Please.
out, they operate on a tiny, measly annual budget of about £3 million, which is nothing. And because of well-being of women, we have ultrasound screens as part of prenatal care. They facilitated and funded that research. They helped fund the research that led to the discovery of the HPV vaccine, which is a key
Really?
tool, for the
Wow.
eradication of cervical cancer, non-hormonal treatments for endometriosis. They're an incredible organization. Their website is wellbeingofwomen.org.uk. They do accept private donations like £5 or £10, and I think their work is incredible and should be celebrated.
But that's even an example where it isn't celebrated enough. You know, that's it's,
Yeah.
I, it's there's something broken in this whole thing. I don't quite know how to fix it, but it's amazing that people like you and well-being of women are doing it. But if they were instrumental into the HPV vaccine, then it's somehow they're just sort of been like rubbed out of that history, kind of.
Yeah, there more people should be aware of the work that well-being of women are doing.
For sure, yeah. And like, how critical do you think it is that this in this whole space has just been sort of sustained through people's passion as opposed to actually funded properly?
Well, people's passion only lasts so long. It's very important, but you can't run on fumes forever. And most of the women's health companies that I know, most of the women's health founders that I know, they're operating in conditions of extreme scarcity. They're not paying themselves well, they're not paying their team well, and they constantly have to facilitate these trade-offs in order to keep their companies afloat. And this type of scarcity-led experience is not going to lead to the best possible outcome. So I think that's necessary in the early days, but we're past the early days.
Who is doing it really well? Any country in the world? Who's doing women's health the best?
Australia is pretty good. Australia has enabled people to obtain cannabidiol-based treatments for their period and pelvic pain. They've had HPV self-sampling for about 5 years now. And just in general, the way in which they treat their healthcare staff is a lot more humane compared to the way UK healthcare staff are being treated.
You mean pay and conditions and work hours? We've come to the end of the show, and in the last couple of minutes, I always ask the entrepreneur or who, well, sorry, it doesn't matter if they're an entrepreneur, whoever's on, what is the motto or phrase that you turn to when things are tough, that you keep repeating, that you want to share with anyone listening who might be going through tough times? Like, what's your go-to phrase?
I don't want this to be super cliched, but when I'm having a really challenging period or about to go into a very important, very challenging meeting, I always repeat to myself the poem "If" by Rudyard Kipling. I was first introduced to it because my mother had printed it out and put it on the wardrobe door of my dad so he could read it every day. And it really feels like the best life philosophy to me. It's so full of wisdom. Every line could be your individual motto. Like, if you can keep your head down when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, it's a fantastic poem. So I usually just repeat that to myself when I'm having a challenging period. And then the last part of it, which says, "And which is more, you'll be a man, my son." I usually just change that to
Change that.
woman.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, look, on that note, Valentina, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And just quickly again before we end, where can people go and find out about your company and your amazing products?
Yourday.com,
Perfect.
YourDaye.com.
Perfect. And thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again with another show next week.